So if you've been here for the last couple of weeks, you know that you're not getting a sermon this morning. So sorry. But learning a little bit about history, that stuff's really important, and we don't talk about it a whole lot in church. And what ends up happening in that is that people know very, very little about what has come before us, and we take for granted things that are so good in our world, and we often repeat the same mistakes over and over again that have happened before us because we don't know a lot about what happened before us. We just know about some things in the Bible, and then we know about some things that happened in American history, and between America and Jesus, there is a whole lot of stuff going on, and we need to know these things. So last week we covered 1,000 years of history, and we're not doing that today. But this is an incredibly, incredibly busy time. 1300 to 1800, busy, busy time. The Mongol Empire kind of took over. The New World was discovered. There was some scientific revolution that actually didn't happen, but we're going to talk about that. Just all sorts of amazing things happened, like New World and just on and on and on. Lots and lots of stuff. But just like last week, I'm just picking three things that I think are the very, very most important for us as Christians to remember from this time, and three people to talk about. So the three things are the Protestant Reformation and religious wars. The other one is the rise of the rule of law, limited government, those sort of things. And the third thing is the big revolution that never happened. The Protestant Reformation, protest, reform. There's a lot of protesting, a lot of reforms that happened. So it's not just one. It's lots and lots of things. There's lots and lots of stuff that's going on. It's happening for all sorts of reasons. And it's going on for several hundred years over a wide geographical area. So it's really, really difficult to talk about like what this thing is and why it happened and who did what and all those sort of things, especially in any sort of succinct way. But I'm going to do the best I can here. The best known person probably from this is Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther King Jr.'s dad, but the Martin Luther from the 1500s. So in 1517, he wrote his 95 theses, which was 95 like grievances that he listed out. He had a lot more than 95, but he started out listing these 95 grievances, and he tacked them onto the community bulletin board at Wittenberg, which was the church door. Sounds crazy today, but that's how you'd kind of spread news, put that on the church door. And they were grievances against the church about selling church positions. Like, hey, here's a really sweet job. Pay me for it, and I'll give you this job. Selling of indulgences, which he saw as unbiblical and taking advantage of people. For forgiveness, for decreasing people's time in purgatory, which he also said isn't real and didn't happen. For relatives that were already dead. So that was a big thing that had, John Tetzel was a guy that Rome had sent out salespeople for this new thing of selling indulgences to buy dead people, out of purgatory. So they would say, think of your poor grandma who is suffering and don't you care, and say, please, please have compassion on me. Throw some coins into the church, offering plate so that we can, so your grandma's not suffering anymore. And so they would really take advantage of people that way. So that was one of the things, one of his 95 things, sales of indulgences, the belief in purgatory, the authority of the Pope. This started, he was intending to start here with some reform to change the church to like, hey, these things need to change. But what started there was a long series of partly reforms, but revolutions, what ended up being religious wars and social conflicts and all sorts of things. And this is really focused on Europe, mainly Western Europe. And there are Christians that are in the rest of the world. They're kind of dying out because, like what we talked about last week, that Christianity was originally a Middle Eastern religion. But then with the rise of Islam, that most of those people wiped out. And so some of these people are still alive during this time, or they're carrying on their faith during this time. But definitely like in the middle of this period that those people are gone. Some of them lived as Christians or as Jews for a while under Islam, but those weren't Christian civilizations anymore, and those Christians eventually died off, with rare exceptions. There's still some kinds like that even today, but for most, why we're talking about Europe. So not to leave that stuff out. So the reason why there was so many problems with the Catholic Church was because, like we'd even talked about a few weeks ago, and this is just kind of a running theme through Christianity, is that since 313, where the church and the state and the church and empire got all mixed in and mingled with each other when Constantine started showing favoritism to the church, and all these things, and all the problems that brought by mixing empire and church, that it had grown so much to the extent that that the church had essentially become an empire. It had a single leader who was not to be questioned, called the Pope. It had an army, but it could also use other people's armies, you know, which was kind of nice, you know. It had vast tracts of land. Maybe as much as a third of Europe was owned by the Catholic Church during this time. And they made money off of that. Just a lot of wealth is in land. They had a system of laws. And like all empires, they had a system for plundering the outlying areas and funneling those resources and wealth into their capital city. So people that lived in Germany and Sweden and things like that, it's like there was two different governments going on, their local government and the church government. And the church had big tracts of land, and they would take money off from, they'd get money from people through enforced tithes, which is a tax when you have to pay it. You know, it's not quite the same as what we think anymore. Whether you go to church or not, you have to pay this according to law. And so a lot of that wealth was taken out of these surrounding nations and funneled back to Rome. It punished, like an empire, it punished people for disloyalty and treason that they called heresy. And punishments went all the way from taking your property away, abusing you in some way, to burning you at the stake. It was incredibly corrupt, especially the higher up you go in the hierarchy. The Jesus movement, like the way of Jesus, was still happening in the church, and sometimes the popes were like very devout, very faithful followers of Jesus. But most of the time, where you see people that are acting and living like Jesus is kind of at the bottom, the Franciscan monks, the Dominican monks, and things like that. And not all of them were perfect either, for sure. People, stories of humans, but most of the time. The real movement of Jesus was happening at the bottom. So the Catholic Church had become an empire when it merged with imperialism. And so this Protestant Reformation was in a lot of ways pushing against not just church or not Christianity or anything like that, but it was pushing against, in so many ways, is pushing against empire. A corrupt empire revolting against it, trying to reform it from the inside. Some people were fighting to reform it. So one of the interesting things that happened is that the countries that were that would get the most profit out of switching from Protestantism to another, from Catholicism to another state religion, they often left. So like a lot of the German states and Sweden, they left and they became Lutheran. And what that meant for them, and the English did this too, and what that meant for them is that the state all of a sudden could seize all the lands and the wealth that the church had in their lands, and they could use that how they wanted to. However, in the southern places like France, for example, and in Spain, those states, those countries had control. They were the main ones that were controlling the Catholic Church in their area. So they didn't leave because the church was a tool of the state. So there's a lot of different like political and dimensions that are going on. And a result of these kind of conflicts is that there's a lot of people that went to war. There's a lot of fighting. A lot of people died. There's something called the 30 Years' War and 100 Years' War, where Protestants and Catholics fought against each other. And these two things combined, about 10 million people died. About 10 million people died. And these are Christians killing Christian people. So like when I said last week that, the big losers as far as the Crusades go, where a million people died, that and most of those million people died of diseases, and most of those people that died were Christians. The big people that lost because of that were Christians who the Crusades furthered this idea that we could advance the cause of Jesus by the sword. And so who ended up paying the price, the most heavy price for this is other Christians. Even in the Crusades, most of the people that ended up dying and paying the price for that were Christians. So, and the reason that these people were fighting, that one army would go and fight another army is because one group of people would say, hey, we're going to be Protestant, we're revolting against Catholicism, or one group would say, we're going to stick with Catholicism. And so they thought that they had to kill each other to resolve that. Great idea. It was really the power of the state that was leading their people to go and fight and kill these people. Because like I had said, a few weeks ago, Rome, they used the religion of Caesar to kind of philosophically hold their empire together. You can worship whatever you want as long as part of what you worship is Caesar. That holds everybody together. So with under the Christian empire, people said, you have to worship Jesus as part of being a part of my kingdom, as part of my empire. And so when things started splitting apart, and some people had Catholicism as their state religion, and some people had Lutheranism or Calvinism or whatever as their state religion, they thought that if you're going to be a part of my kingdom, that you have to be a part of the state religion, that you can't have diversity within your state. Like whoever is in charge has to decide what the religion is. And then you have to stamp out whoever is there, because whoever doesn't agree with the state's religion is committing treason. They're not loyal to the state. Same sort of mentality. So it was this politics of empire and state and religion was all so messed up, mixed up together. So different municipalities went to war against each other over this stuff. And then different kingdoms and political groups, city states and things like that. They also persecuted and killed people that weren't Catholics would kill Protestants, and Protestants would kill Catholics, and Protestants would, and both groups would kill Protestants that weren't their brand of Protestant. So a lot of people died that way. Another result is that Europe went from this big word here, religious homogeny, to religious diversity, meaning that there's one religion and everything is all the same, to there's diversity. And it doesn't mean that there's religious liberty. Most of the time, people had to go to America for that. You know, like if you want to, for the most part, if you wanted to be able to believe what you want to believe and not be persecuted for it, didn't work out perfectly here. But for the most part, if you wanted that, you had to leave Europe and come to the United States for that. But all of a sudden there was diversity, because there was different kinds of Protestantism in England than there was in Switzerland than what there was in Germany. And there's Catholicism in different places. So you're beginning to have a little bit of diversity. And then on the ground level, people are beginning to read, to believe different things. One thing that everybody was against, like I said, everybody was against these kind of like non-state branches of Christianity called Anabaptists. People that were not a part of any sort of state religion. They weren't Lutheran. They weren't Episcopalian. They weren't Catholic. They weren't Lutheran. So if you're just none of these things, then they were all hunted down. Voluntary church membership was seen as dangerous, meaning like that you could, the idea that you could just go, that you yourself could go and pick out whatever church you wanted to go to, whatever you wanted to believe, was considered a dangerous thought, which meant, because to them that meant anarchy, right? Because if you are a part of a Lutheran state and you think that you can just pick, you're like, you're not even, it's not treason because you're not wanting to go to the, you know, you're not wanting to side with the Catholics, but you just think that you can decide for yourself. That's anarchy. It's craziness. That was just their mindset. So all of those people were, a lot of theological changes. The printing press had been invented. And so people, Bibles began to be more readily available to people. There was a lot of like religious pamphlets that were being handed out. People began to read more. Something that had, I believe, started by Martin Luther, sola fide, sola scriptura, faith alone, scripture alone, that you don't need the Pope or you don't need somebody else to tell you what to believe and tell you what scripture says. Luther thought that if everybody read scripture, they would just understand things like he did, you know, so that's partly, you know, and then when he starts to see that other people are reading scripture and they have different ideas about things than he does, then he thought that it wasn't okay. But those ideas of, hey, you are an individual and that you are responsible for yourself before God and you are saved by faith. You're not saved by, being a part of some state religion, began to shape people's abilities for free thought and individualism. And that began to change a lot of things. Another interesting change that this brought about, all this fighting and all this conflict, is all of a sudden people began kind of like fighting for the attention and for believers for the first time in a long, long time in Europe. Because when you have, before this, a lot of Catholic churches, they just sat empty and local priests preached to empty, to empty buildings, which is really, like, people went out fishing. They did all sorts of things. We think Christendom, people, everybody's in church. No, no one was in church because they didn't need to be in church because all of the, you know, all of the church didn't have to get, popular support, you know, because they had police power, they had empire power to back them up. And so all of a sudden you have these movements in Christianity where there people are spreading out, giving out pamphlets and talking to people about faith and saying, hey, read this, let's talk about this, let's talk about these things. And so people are being engaged on a faith level like they haven't been before. And so it's becoming more real. People are engaging in their own beginning faith traditions. The Catholic Church begins changing and starts talking to people in real ways. For the first time in a long time, literacy rates go up, biblical knowledge goes up, education goes up, and it ends up being a lot more, creating a lot more theological and biblical understanding. And one little kind of like side caveat to this that was a little different that is also a big hot button topic during this time is the Spanish Inquisition. This is kind of a part of this Reformation movement, but it's kind of a side topic, but it's thrown in sometimes. But this happened from 1492 to 1834. Long, long time. And that's one of those things like, oh, you Christians, terrible, Spanish Inquisition. And it was terrible. But we also need to, like, just like what we talked about last week, there's things that are important to know about it. So it's almost, what it was is after 770 years of fighting, the European Christians finally kicked the Moorish Muslims back out of Spain, and then 1492, same year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and then this law was passed, same law that the Muslims, a reverse law of what the Muslims had passed when they'd taken over Spain, saying everybody that's here, you have to convert or leave. Islam or leave. So Christians said, everybody here, Jewish, Christian, you have to convert, or Jewish or Muslim, you have to convert to Christianity or leave. And so a lot of people left, or they were expelled, they were kicked out. And then there was Jews and Christians that became, or Jews and Muslims that became Christians through coercion or had to leave. And the state was really concerned. The state, like I said, the state saw that if you weren't a Christian, there's no way that you could be, and a Catholic Christian, there's no way that you could be actually a good citizen. So you would be seen as a threat to the state. Because people have been fighting these religious wars for so long. And they thought if you weren't a good Catholic, then you couldn't be a good citizen of Spain. And so there was these investigations going on about, have you really converted? Are you really a Christian? Are you really a good Catholic? And though it was church people that were leading this Inquisition, all of these people worked for the state. And so this was a state thing. They were investigating treason, basically, but it was along kind of religious lines. And during this period of time, 300 years almost, 3,000 people died. It's terrible and it's awful, but it's also, in comparison to so many things, it's not the big, like, oh my gosh, massacre. We've done worse things. So, 150,000 people were charged with crimes. And an interesting thing about this is that most of the people charged with crimes were wealthy people, and often they were Jewish people, and the penalty for their crimes was confiscation of property. So people that were running the Inquisition and people that were working for the state used their power for corrupt things. People targeted people to take their wealth away. Another interesting thing that we need to kind of remember is that about 2% of these people were tortured, you know. And I find it very interesting that the two main torture was considered a very reasonable part of the interrogation process if you really believe that somebody was actually faithfully a Muslim or a Jewish person or not faithful to the state, and you needed to question them further, that they would torture them. Wasn't everybody's about 2%? But I think that it's very interesting that main ways that they would torture people was waterboarding and joint dislocation. Do you know who also says, hey, this is good stuff to do, joint dislocation and waterboarding for anyone that we are afraid might be enemies of the state? Us, that's right. That's right. And there are plenty of Christian Americans that say, I don't know, man, if it can save American lives, if we think that they're enemies of the state, we should subject them to these things and even worse. So we look back at this stuff and we say, this is incredibly wrong. And it is. But can we look at the things today and say, this is incredibly wrong? Say, it's just waterboarding. It's just joint dislocation, putting them on the rack and stretching them out or whatever. We do it in different ways today. Not that different ways, actually, sometimes. Waterboarding still works very, very much the same. Can we see that it's wrong back then and now? But one of the reasons talking about this and talking the Protestant Reformation and all these religious wars and the Inquisition is so important is because Christians are and should be a self-critical people. We should be a self-critical people. We should look at our history and say, where does this line up with Jesus? Where in our history have we fallen away from this way of Jesus? And I couldn't find anybody. Maybe there is somebody, but I couldn't find anybody during this time that was killing and torturing people out of what seemed like any sort of like fervent faith, like belief in Jesus. You know, like I'm going to go and kill these people. I mean, I'm sure there was people then and a twisted sort of an idea of faith, but we need to look at these things and we think, you know, how can our institutions, our Christian institutions, how can we be led astray in these things, and what part do we need to own in this? I think those are really important questions. But another part of this is that Christians, I believe, are uniquely self-critical. There's a lot of other groups in this world that are not as self-critical as about their own history as what Christians are. I don't see the same level of self-criticism among atheists and agnostics, and I don't see it among Muslims and things like that. I don't see it as much in Hindus. I don't know a whole lot about Buddhists as far as that stuff goes. But Christians are a self-critical group of people, and we should be. But it's kind of but sometimes we need to put that in the proper place, because it's a healthy thing to be self-critical among other people who are in a mature way are self-critical. You know, it can be, that's a proper place for that. But if you are self-critical in an environment of people that are not, but are you critical, then it's not healthy. Does that make sense? You say, hey, here's some of my flaws. Here's some things that I haven't done right. And then other people reciprocate by saying, yeah, you know, and jumping on top of you and not being honest about their own flaws. You know, we need to think seriously about the merging of state and empire. What ended up happening to the church, up until this point, was that the church became a tool of the state, became its own empire, became a tool of the state, and it became something that in a lot of ways was unrecognizable when you hold up Jesus and you hold this stuff up and you say, where did we get off track here? How did this get so far away? How did this end up looking so much like Rome that killed Jesus and so far away from looking like the person that is the center of our faith? This Jesus that said, my kingdom is not of this world. And then we came up with this. I think it's important for us to remember that most of these people that were doing a lot of the killing, going to doing the religious wars, burning people at stakes and things like that, they were doing it for the state, and they were just doing their job. And that's a dangerous thing, that Christian or not, that all of us are susceptible to. I think the last 100 years of history and psychology and things show us that if you put human beings in the right conditions and the right environments and you tell them the right things, that our propensity to just do our job and hurt and kill other people and do evil is astounding. And we would all like to think, hey, I could never do that. That could never be me. But we need to be careful about those thoughts. And we'd be much safer to know that can be me. And I could do that. And that I am a human too, susceptible to those things. And I'll go a little quicker through these next two. The rise of the rule of law and natural rights, human rights. So there's this narrative that we have in the West that says something like human life and society and civilization and things like that, it took off in the 17th and 18th centuries, whenever the church was got weak enough through these religious wars that finally, like, humanity could break free of its shackles of ignorance, superstition of religion, especially Christianity, and began creating modern civilization. The problem with that is that it's incredibly and historically unfounded. It's a big, big lie. Things like individual rights, personal freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, freedom of association, this idea that there's human rights, universal human rights, the idea that a government only has legitimacy if it rules by the consent of the governed, the idea that a government gets its legitimacy through being right and just and good, and not just by being strong. The belief that that humans are born with a sin nature, and therefore our legal systems and our political system needs to have checks and balances to balance out, to keep power in check, because we're all susceptible. Ultimate power corrupts ultimately. These are things that we kind of take for granted today, that we enjoy about our society, we enjoy about like about modern life, but they are unique in human history, and they all came from fundamental Christian beliefs, and they all and they really emerged quite during this time, as we were as empire and Christianity were separating a bit. So they stem from the beliefs that God, that we all have God-given free will, that we're all going to be accountable to God in the end. And so therefore, since God does so much to honor our own free will and our own choice, then our societies need to do that too. The belief in a moral order in the universe that is established by a moral God was a huge fundamental belief in this, and the beliefs that societies as much as possible should reflect this moral order that God has established in the world, and that the better that these societies do this, the more that human beings and humanity will flourish. These were all like fundamental beliefs that came out of this stuff. The idea of human rights, universal human rights, because we are created in the image of God, came out of Christianity. And amazingly, these theological beliefs, when they were put into practice, because that's just what they were. But at some point, these were untested theological beliefs about God and humanity. And then when they are put to test, guess what? They work out. They work out. Human life and human societies flourished when these ideas about God and the nature of the world and about human beings were made as the basis for society. Societies flourished. There is a pastor named Augusto Zimmerman that explains the roots of our legal system this way. He says, our laws are heavily influenced by Christian philosophy. The philosophy argues that there is divine reason for the existence of fundamental laws, and that such laws are superior to man-made legislation, thus reflecting universal and unchangeable principles by which everyone should live. To kind of wrap our minds around a little bit about what he's saying is that there's always been laws, like kings pass laws, you know. Here's a law, I want everybody to like give me all your money. You know, if I'm king, I can pass, you know, sign everything over to me. And it's the law, you know. Does that mean that it's right? No. But these beliefs are based on the idea that laws should conform to the universal righteousness and the universal moral order and laws of God. And that those are worked out theologically and things like that about who, but they are all based on who God is. And so there are laws that it would be immoral for you to follow. All the way back in the 13th century, monk, theologian, philosopher, legal scholar Thomas Aquinas said that unjust law, cooked law, should not be obeyed. Radical stuff. There's a guy named William Blackstone that his writing, so much of his stuff is just foundational to a lot of, especially English, but a lot of Western civil law. Hugely influential. He stated that no human law could be valid if it contradicted God's higher law, laws which maintain and regulate God's natural human rights to life, liberty, and property. Freedom of speech is one of the most important ingredients in human liberty. God, he goes on, when he created matter and endured it with the principle of mobility, established certain rules for the perpetual direction of that motion, so that when he created man and endued him with free will to conduct himself in all parts of life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature whereby that free will is in some degree regulated and restrained, and gave him also the faculty of reason to discover the purport of those laws. The rule of law, human rights, limited government are deeply rooted in this Christian worldview. And for the first time in history, the Christians began breaking away from some of the established stuff and creating governments based on these fundamental Christian beliefs. And it began changing the world. The United States came of that. Our Constitution came of that. It's not perfect, but it's a whole lot better than all everything else that's come before that. And we have a lot to be grateful for here, so much to be grateful for here. These are things that we do not want to give up. We do not want to give up. And if we buy into this lie that Christianity is the thing that holds this stuff back instead of the thing that gives it life, that eventually we might be in danger of losing these things. I've seen it when after 9/11, when so much we started talking about American lives and American this and American that. It's nationalism and it's imperialism. We need to take care of our own people. We do. However, we cannot do that at the expense of denying the human worth and dignity and value of other people. I didn't hear in this rhetoric the foundational beliefs that started our country that said we consider it self-evident that all people are created equal. Our Bill of Rights. We have these Bill of Rights because people believed that these are inalienable rights. These are natural rights that all people have. And so we had these written down to be guaranteed that the state would not infringe on these things. But that means that we believe that this is life, liberty, this pursuit of happiness, this right to free speech and all of these things, to not be falsely imprisoned. Hello, renditioning America, you know, that these are human rights. And we don't need to go and like try to save the world necessarily, but we certainly don't need to trample on other human beings and take away the rights that our country was founded on, believing that all humans have, because they are precious people created in the image of God. It means that doing what is legal and doing what is right isn't always the same thing. And it means that we need to work hard to value to do what's right and to value the human worth and dignity and the natural rights that we believe that God has given to all people. And real quick on the along the same lines here, the scientific revolution that actually never happened. The idea is kind of the same thing as by the same group of Enlightenment philosophers, that none of them were actually scientists, but they kind of put out there that this myth that scientific progress was locked away by the church and that it massively tortured people and suppressed learning and all this stuff, on and on and on. And that finally it could break free of the chains of church during the 16th and 17th century, and finally they could science could emerge and progress. The only problem with that, same thing as before, it's just an incredible lie. Science came to us. It was not a revolution. It has been an evolution of people making contribution after contribution, year after year, generation after generation. It wasn't something that just exploded necessarily at a certain time. There was a lot of achievements during this period, but that's for other reasons. Science is actually a uniquely Christian phenomenon. And I know that's a really big statement, but it's look it up. It's pretty amazing. But I'll just say this, with rare exception, extremely rare exception, for almost all of history, every scientist that has ever been and all the people that are that are building up to that have been Christians. This is based on some unique Judeo-Christian beliefs. The beliefs that the world is progressing forward. It's not just repeating itself over and over and over again, that it's progressing towards something and that something is good. So that means that we should be engaged in progress, that orients our minds toward being engaged in progress and making a better world and discovering things. The other one is that Christians believe that the universe was created by a rational and intelligent designer. And if the world is heading towards something and it was created by a rational and an intelligent designer, then therefore the laws that govern that order of the universe can be discovered. And so as you are pursuing this order in the universe, you are learning more about your creator as you study the creation. So like the legal stuff, the same stuff with science, all of this started with a theological belief. Before there was science, or even its precursor of natural philosophy, there was this belief, this faith stuff, that there's this God that is rational and orderly created this ordered universe. And so in setting out on living out this faith view, it became true more and more and more and more, discovered to be true. It was validated over and over again. Until very, very recently, almost all Christians pursued their work as they were pursuing God. They considered that part of their spiritual journey, part of the pursuit of God is to investigate nature. Just one example. In his last will and testament, the 17th century chemist, Robert Boyle, wished the members of the Royal Society of London, which was a scientific society, continued success in their laudable attempts to discover the nature of the works of God. There's this myth that is put out in our society that science and religion, that science and Christianity, are antagonists to each other. And if you want to be a good scientist, you can't really believe in God. You can't believe in these myths of Christianity. But it's just not true. It's only just very, very recently, that people began being scientists really that are not Christians, that don't have really devout, faith in God and don't see their work as scientists as being a part of their pursuing God in the world. Science and all its benefits exist in the world, not in spite of Christianity, but because of it. And during this time, there was an explosion of scientific discovery, partly because it had been building for such a long time, partly because there was a printing press and you could share information. Another famous person, Isaac Newton, physicist, said, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. If I have seen further, it is because I have been, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. He's just saying what I've been telling all along, that science is a product of Christianity that has been building for a long, long time. three people that I think that we need to. Is everybody okay? I mean, I'm fine with cutting it off here. Okay. It's just hard to summarize this major changing world in 300 years so quickly. But three people that I think the overarching stuff is important, but I think these stories are also important because human beings, we go off of stories. There's a man named Menno Simons. I think he's one of the most important people that we need to know from this time. He was a priest, a Catholic priest in the Netherlands, that he became a part of this Anabaptist movement, this radical, like, I'm not going to join any state-sponsored religion. He believed in being a pacifist, which was also not okay. You know, got to hunt those people down. What if that idea gets around, you know? Then who are we going to get to kill people? Can't have that. He was a priest who became an Anabaptist minister. There was a bounty on his head. People that were associated with him were tortured and killed in order by the people that were trying to find him. And he didn't hurt anybody. He never hurt anybody. His second year of being a priest, he had never read the Bible before, if you can imagine. but he starts reading the Bible, and he discovers Jesus that's in there. And he falls in love with this Jesus and says, I want to be like him. And he looks around at the Anabaptists who are around him, or who are a lot of times getting killed because they don't fit anybody's state religion. Some of them are actually legitimately crazy people, but some of them are really pretty great, like very Jesus-looking people. And he says, I see a lot of this Jesus in these people, and I want to be one of them. And yeah, it might mean that I have to suffer and die for my faith, but when I look at this Jesus here, that seems like what my Jesus had to do too. So why should it be any different for me than it is for my King? So he became an Anabaptist. He spent the rest of his life in hiding and in danger. His family was always in danger. He did a lot of writing, talking about what it meant to be a Christian, commentary on the Bible, things like that, talking about believers' baptism, this idea that you need to make a grown-up adult choice whether you're going to be a follower of Jesus or not. It's not something that your mama can do for you or your daddy can do for you when you are an infant, but that you need to make an adult choice about who you are and who you're going to be. Radical stuff. But it also, even though this was a minority movement, it changed a lot of the ways that people thought about what it means to be human, what it means to be Christian. Hugely influential. And he talked about how it's wrong for Christians to use the use of force to advance Christianity. And unfortunately, that was radical for the time, unfortunately. But it wasn't radical for the first 300 years of the church, but it was radical after empire and Christianity got merged together. There's a lady named Katharina Zell. And God, I want to thank you for the life of Menno Simons. He's part of our great cloud of witnesses. He's somebody that has risked persecution for your name. Catherine Zell, she's just a lady that lived in Germany during the time of the Protestant Reformation. And she loved God. And she thought that that Lutheranism, that it reflected the God that she knew. She was educated. She taught children. She taught kids how to read. She was the first person that we know that married a pastor. This didn't happen in Roman Catholicism because priests were always celibate. But she's the first one that we know that married a pastor. And she did it partly, this guy named Matthew Zell, and she did it partly because she loved him and partly because she felt like it was a way of living out her faith, this freedom of what it really means to be a Christian and the life that God wants for us. They became partners in ministry until he died about 20 years later. But they worked all their lives together as Christians. They educated children. She started a number of, she probably started like the first like WMU Ladies Missions Union. I don't know if you've ever heard of those. But she started ministering to a group of ladies, writing devotions for them and teaching them and things like that. And then these ladies, they also were a powerhouse of like ministering to the people in their region and in their city. So as the Reformation was going on, they would take care of the families of people that had where the fathers had been lost in these wars of persecution and religious wars. They took people in and they fed them. They gave people safe places to stay. And all of her life, she lived out her faith in simple ways. But it was a place. But she lived out this way of peace and goodness in the middle of a war-torn land. She lived in the heart of this area where most of these people, most of these 10 million people that I talked about, died. God, we thank you for her life. Last guy. Robert Raikes. He was the son. He's a British son of a printer. He was educated by his father, and he ran this newspaper that his father had left for him. And his father was a great man of God that he admired a lot. And he was walking home from work one day. He's walking home from church, and he sees these kids. They're all fighting like terribly in the streets, and he pulls them all apart, and he's like, "What are you guys doing?" And they just look at him and they run away, like they're just dirty and they're filthy and they're starving looking. And he turns to this lady, then he says, "Do you know what's wrong with these kids?" And she said, "Oh, they're just slaves, a bunch of white slaves." And he's like, "What do you mean?" He said, "These kids." It shows you like the social separation that happens in society sometimes. This had to be happening all around him, but he just noticed it this day for the first time. But she said, "These kids, they work in the factories and they work in the mills 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and Sunday's the only day that they have off. And so when they're free on Sundays, they just run wild like wild animals, you know, just going crazy." And he started thinking about these kids, that they don't have enough food to eat and they don't have a future. They don't know how to read. And he said, I would be one of these kids if my dad had died, if I didn't have my dad, if he didn't educate me, if he didn't invest in me." And just, it broke his heart over these little people. And so he got together with his pastor and he said, "I want to start this thing called Sunday school." He said, "What? What is Sunday school?" He said, "These kids, it's the only day that they have, and I want to get these kids together, and I want to teach them so they can have a hope and a future, and they can know that God loves them." And so he started telling children, like, "Hey, come to church on Sundays, and I'll teach you how to read." And so the first Sunday, you know, those kids were so excited that, like, one of them came, you know? And, their only day off. And so... he said, "Why don't the other kids come?" And he said, "Well, that's their only day off, and we don't have the right kind of clothes to wear, and we just don't think that we would belong." And so he said, "You just tell everybody that as long as they can wash their hands and their face, then they're good enough to come to school." So, and he gave her a little penny, and said, "Thank you for coming." And so he would do that as much as he could. He'd give these little kids money when they come. And so pretty soon he had about 100 kids that he was teaching from 6 years old all the way up to 16. But he was teaching them how to read. He was teaching them the Bible. They were all hanging out in a safe environment. Nobody was messing with them. Nobody was hurting them. They weren't in danger of getting nabbed by anybody while they're running the streets. And he looked out for them and tried to make sure that they had clothes to wear. And so they kept coming and they kept And they got an education, and they learned about God. They learned about that God loves them and that God's people loves them. And then 3 years into this, Robert began writing about what he had been doing in his newspaper. And so other people heard about this, and they said, "Do this." When a short period of time, about 4,000 other Sunday schools started across England. And so more and more of these kids were being pulled out of their off of the streets, and they were being taught, and they were being given a hope and a future. Eventually, this Sunday school thing, as it led to more and more people knowing these street urchins and caring about them, knowing their stories, that it led to legislative reform and to children's rights. It was just a simple man walking down the street on a Sunday, willing to have his heart broken by the world around him, grateful for what God had given him, and seeing what God, thinking about maybe what could God do with the gifts that God had given him. How could he give that back to the broken world around him? All things that you and I are capable of. And that's why we have Sunday school today. Not so that people can sit in circles and just pontificate about religious things that they're never actually going to live out. But Sunday school started because God broke somebody's heart over the needs of little street urchins that were all around him. God, we thank you for his life.